From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
The uniquely talented singer-songwriter Jill Sobule died at the age of 66 on May 1st, 2025. She perished in a fire in Woodbury, Minnesota, where she was to perform songs from her one-woman musical, F the Seventh Grade. She rose to fame in 1995 when a song from her second album, I Kissed a Girl, became not only a hit, but the first song with an openly gay theme ever to reach the charts. I recorded an interview with Jill Sobule in 2017, but before we listen to it, let's begin with her most famous song, I Kissed a Girl.
Over and told me about Fred. He's such a hairy behemoth, she said. Dumb as a box of hammers, but he's such a handsome guy. And I opened up and I told her about Larry. And yesterday how he asked me to marry. And I'm not giving him an answer yet. I think I can do better. So we left, compared notes. We had a drink, we had a smoke. She took off her overcoat. I kissed a girl. I kissed a girl. She called home to say she'd be late. He said he worried, but now he feels safe. I'm glad you're with your girlfriend. Tell her hi for me. And then I looked at you, you had guilt in your eyes, but it only lasted a little while. And then I felt your hand above my knee. And we laughed at the world. They can have their diamonds and we'll have our pearls. I kissed a girl. She was just like kissing me. Kiss the girl won't change the world, but I'm so glad I kissed the girl. And we laugh at the world. They can have their diamonds and we'll have our pearls. Kissed a girl for the first time. I kissed a girl and I may do it again. I kissed a girl. I kissed a girl. I kissed a girl, her lips were sweet. She was just like kissing.
The late Jill Sobule's 1995 hit, I Kissed a Girl. Now here is my interview with Jill Sobule, recorded in 2017.
Jill Sobule joins me this week. Jill Sobule is a very talented singer, songwriter. She has many fine albums and has collaborated on lots of interesting projects, which I hope to talk to her about in a bit. Jill Sobule, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
It's really nice to talk to you. You've been in music for over 20 years, which is like hard to believe. I guess time flies.
Oh, I know, and it gets faster all the time. I still can't believe I'm doing this.
You mean talking to me on the telephone or having a career in music?
Well, that's special, but still doing music. But I guess I have no marketable skills to do anything, so that's why.
Well, when did you realize, you know, that you were going to be or have a career in music?
You know, I don't know if it was a career, but I always had the bands in grade school and junior high school and high school. But, you know, I thought, like, you know, you can't really make a living doing that. And it was my first love. But I was pretty smart. And I went to school in my third year. I was somehow I thought of myself I was going to be in the diplomatic corps. I wanted to go to Georgetown International Relations. But on my third year of college, I went to Spain. And a friend and I said, let's go busk on the street where all the street musicians play. And to make a long story short, a guy walked by who owned a nightclub, and he hired us to play his club. And I ended up not telling the parents and dropping out of school and playing that nightclub. And I think, I wonder if that guy had not walked by, if I'd be doing that. Yeah, so.
When you were a little girl, did you dream about being a pop star?
I wanted to be international spy first. But yeah, I mean, my parents were great because, especially back then, you know, there weren't really many role models for girls playing guitar and playing electric. And my parents bought me a Gibson SG, and I used my brother, who was 6 years older than me, I used his Marshall amp. And so you had this 11-year-old rocking out with a fuzz pedal and her brother's amp that was twice her size. And that, so I suppose there was a fantasy. International spy was maybe just a notch above rock star. But you know what? I didn't write lyrics. I didn't write songs until much later.
So originally you were just a lyricist and someone else was writing the music?
No, I just wanted to be a guitar player. I wanted to be the first female Jimi Hendrix or Jeff Beck.
Mm.
And then it was actually later than that, you know, after, you know, those the puberty years. And a little later, actually, where I was like, oh, I want to put my feelings into songs.
Had you been a writer that kept a journal or a diary or whatever?
Yeah, basically that was my journal.
The songs were?
The songs were.
Yeah,
they were terrible, too. Someone found a cassette of early songs of mine that I just had played for her and a few people, and they, I was no young prodigy, put it that way.
You had to learn your craft.
Well, you know what it was, too? Even I think with my first record, it was learning to put my own personality into the songs, the who I am, how I would write, and who I admired. And I remember listening to my brother's John Prine records and Joni records, and I was like,
those were the things that appealed to you when you were younger. When you mentioned Guitar Hero, so what was the kind of music that you, well, you know, when you were 12, what were you listening to?
Well, I was really lucky because, like I said, I had, you know, some of my friends were listening to the teeny bopper music. I had a brother 6 years older than me and who had the rock band in town, so there was music everywhere. You know what I really loved? Well, of course, when I was really little, the Beatles were everything to me.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you had your singer-songwriters, the classic ones. But then I started really liking, I actually loved the storytellers. So I loved the John Prines, the Leonard Cohens, the Joni Mitchells. I liked the storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also liked funk and R&B. So it was a real big mixed bag, same as it is now.
Well, that's interesting, since you ended up working with Todd Rundgren on your first album, because he's a guy who's very influenced by both sides, too. You know, he's a funkadelic singer-songwriter guy.
Yeah, he has a Philly soul, and yeah, I was a big Todd fan. And like you said, he did my first album was with Todd. First time ever in the studio was with Todd Rundgren. It was very intimidating.
Was that in Woodstock, or where was that?
Yeah, Mink Hollow.
Yeah. How classic. So, well, how did that come about? How did you go from busking in Spain to working with Todd Rundgren?
Well, you know, when I came back to Denver, I had the bug and would play. I remember my first gigs were open mics. Then I got my own shows, and I had a couple bands, started playing my own songs. And there was a guy, my last show in Denver, I had a goodbye to Denver. I became a very semi celebrity in Denver as far as, you know, music. And it was my last show, my goodbye. I was moving to New York City. And before I left, there was a guy there who was a publisher for Warner Brothers who had just happened to be in Denver vacationing and liked what I did. And so he put up a showcase for me. Like there was one in Nashville that was like CMJ, but it was called Nashville Extravaganza. They don't have it anymore. And I played a show, and there was a bunch of the record company people in there. There was a, you know, I had my choice of three different labels, and I probably picked the wrong one. But it was so funny, because at the time, I mean, I just thought being kind of a semi-celebrity in Denver was really great. I wanted to move to New York just to find new musicians to play with, so it wasn't like I was that ambitious. It just kind of, again, like that guy happened to be at that club at my last show. Same with the guy who walked by. So there was a little bit of luck involved or something.
You were in the right place at the right time.
I was in the right place, yes.
Yeah, or they were or whatever. But so you had a choice of the three labels, and you went with MCA. What were the other labels that you could have chosen? How could you have chosen the wrong one? MCA seems like a good
MCA,
label.
MCA, they called it Music Cemetery Association. But they didn't quite know what to do with me, that's for sure. None of them have really known what to do with me. But that Todd record was... one of the reasons I worked with Todd was because the woman who was my A&R person was, you know, I was a Todd fan, but I wasn't a Todd head. They were like the great, you know, deadheads. There were people who were Todd fanatics, and she was a bit of a Todd fanatic. So I think part of it was her wanting to meet him.
Well, I can use Jill to meet Todd Rundgren.
Right, and it was a time when, you know, that there was a few little red flags. Where, you know, I remember the guy from XTC said, you know, this is the worst experience working with Todd. And there was a couple other that he was a difficult guy to work with. And he was, you know, I love Todd. But it was a tough one for my very first record.
In what ways was he difficult? I mean, I don't know him. All I know is what I hear in the record. But, and you know, I know he did a lot of his own, you know, he recorded a lot of things all by himself in his room.
Oh, yeah, those records were fantastic. Well, you know, being a producer, you know, you can be a genius, but also I think it's good to have people skills. And I think for my first record, it could have been, maybe it wasn't the best choice, maybe for my second record when I had more confidence. But I remember one time going into the studio and, you know, being so green, and I sang a vocal, and he'd go, all right, that's adequate. Let's move on to the next one. Because, you know, like, talk about
Did you go home
killing.
And think, oh, man, I'm adequate?
But that was just him, and he didn't mean, you know, it was just he was not effusive. And sometimes you want someone to...
Well, I would imagine when you're first getting started, you need a little bit more.
It was a tough one, but, you know, I learned. It was on one hand, it was good to learn, you know, just in the fire, I must say. So, but it's also interesting. It was also partly me being not as assertive as I should have done, because you're here with someone that, you know, I meet people that are celebrities or amazing people in music or in movies or writers. And as you get older, you're like, yeah, you know, like, that's great. But when they're ones that you loved as a kid or you listened to in those impressionable years, like you're saying, at 12 or 13, you can never get over that.
Right.
And that's what with Todd, that was probably a hard thing for me to do.
Well, when you're doing concerts now, which I know you do a lot of, is there anything that from things are different that you things here are different that you still say, oh, I'm going to play something from there?
You know, I forget about that record, and I think, and then someone will ask me to play a song, and I'll go, oh, and then I'll be like, yeah. I think there's some of those songs I really love, and I forget about those.
Well, it was a while ago, I guess.
It was a while ago, and I think I hadn't yet, maybe, I'm rediscovering some older songs as I'm going through my catalog. But like I said, I think that I was a late bloomer.
How old were you when this album came out?
I was a late bloomer then. Was I 27?
Uh-huh. Yeah, as opposed to 19.
So yeah, here's another thing that was funny. Oh no, that was in 95.
Right.
It wasn't for that record, but in 94 when I was going for my next record, and there were three labels who wanted to sign me. And one of them was like, and this was 95, where you'd think things were a little better than 4 years ago. And they were like, we'd love to sign you, but we already have one female. We already have a female on the label, songwriter. And then the other one says, we'd love to sign you, but you're a little bit too old for us.
Oh, yeah, because you're 27.
Yeah. So I remember when I saw him like a year and a half later, when my first single, it was the first Kiss a Girl, came out, and I saw him at some sort of industry party, and he came up to me really sweet and says, oh, I'm so happy, you know, for you. And I remember talking to him like the Beverly Hillbillies grandma, like, who are you, Sonny? You know, who are you? You know, and I was like, well, guess I wasn't too old, buddy.
Yeah. In your face, man.
I did feel bad I made him cry.
That's good.
Well, yeah. I felt kind of bad.
Well, you say you were on Atlantic. Was that the label that put out your second album?
Yes.
So did you hang with Ahmet Erdogan and meet all those guys?
You know, I did get to meet Ahmet. And I remember the first time I met him, he leaned over, kissed my hand, and he said, I kissed a girl. Man, I'll never forget that.
That's very
and
cool.
Only he could have gotten away with that.
Yeah. Well,
it was a guy from another era.
Yeah.
But, oh, yeah, that was exciting.
A cool guy.
Did you meet him?
I never met him, no. Gosh, I'd love to have, but I bought a lot of the records that he put out, including Jill Sobule. Wow, well, that's such a great record, and I think that's when most of us heard about you for the first time, and I Kissed a Girl was such a huge thing, and it was on MTV, and it was, it's interesting how your career is kind of straddles the enormous changes in the music industry that have happened, you know, right almost when you got there, you know, just when everything started changing. Did I Kissed a Girl create a kind of expectation for your career that it didn't follow through, or was that exactly what you wanted, or I don't know what I'm asking.
I didn't know what I wanted. Like I said, it was always, you know, the guy finding me, you know, on the streets of Sevilla. But I have to say that, you know, there might have been some choices that I could have made differently, but then, you know.
You mean after I Kissed a Girl?
Well, yeah, I don't think they knew what to do with me. First of all, with I Kissed a Girl, they didn't know what to do with that subject matter. At first, they thought, like, this is really kind of a cool, funny, trendy thing, but they didn't want anything gay in it. You know? So I remember hearing. I also remember, oh my God, the first time I sat down with everyone at Atlantic Records, at my first meeting the marketing people. There was a big conference table and the A&R, and they were laughing. They were going, oh, thank God that we have, you know, we have a straight woman. And they were like making fun of Melissa Etheridge and Tracy Chapman, and assuming that I was, you know, completely.
And then you came up with that song.
Well, they thought that really, they thought it was just kind of almost Katy Perry-ish in a way, where it was just like, you know, oh, you know, it's cute. And so that's what they wanted to do. Rather, when I wanted to actually figure out how to have the first pop song that had a bisexual or lesbian kiss in it, and the only way to do it at that time was the, you know, you had to subvert it with some kind of humor or goofiness, and so, you know, that's what I did.
A novelty song, right?
Pardon?
A novelty song.
Yeah, they wanted to see it as a novelty song. I remember I went to the, oh my God, I had to do the morning zoo shows, and you'd be, you know, the nutty guy with the Hawaiian shirt DJ would be like, hey, you and I have something in common. I go, what? We both kissed a girl. Hey.
Oh, <God.
laughs> And you'd have to, like, laugh because you wanted them to play the song. And I remember doing the video, and I loved the video. And at the very end, we had a kiss with the girl, and they took it out.
They cut it out of the video?
Yeah, they cut it out.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So I think that the label didn't quite know what to do with me, and then on my end, when I did the next record, Happy Town, it was kind of a rebellion of, you know what, I'm going to do a really weird and semi-dark record, you know, like maybe that's not the best commercial thing to do, but also it was, you know, odd timing, because I think at that time it was Alanis Morissette, and it was
Liz Phair,
and kind of more angsty rather than whatever I was doing that had, you know, some sort of little bit of humor, even though there was, you know, different layers to it. So you know, I've not followed trends.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're listening to an interview I recorded with Jill Sobule in 2017. She died on May 1st, 2025, at the age of 66. Here's a song of Jill Sobule's from her 1997 album, Happy Town. The song is called Clever.
How sorry about your windshield. I'd be sorry. And I can be clever. Oh, I could be clever. I can charm your pants off. I can be clever.
I particularly love Clever on Happy Town. I think that's one of your great songs.
Oh, thank you.
It's funny and dark and all those things that you were just talking about.
And that's what I mean about developing songwriting, is that I wouldn't have written that earlier. But that's the way I was in my real life. That's the way I would have talked. That's the way I would have... it was being, not brave, that's not the right thing, but being confident enough to put my own sensibility into my songwriting. And so Clever is kind of an indication of that.
I also love Super 8 on Happy Town.
Oh, I have a story about that one.
Well, do tell.
Well, for those who don't know it, it's really, it opens with the sound of a Super 8, projector, and it's looking at old home movies and, seeing your parents and always, you'd have to hear the song, but it's a lot of little nostalgia, and I talk about the birthday parties and the people in it, and one of the lines is, and there's Carol Fingle before she sliced her wrist. Now, Carol Fingle did not slice her wrist. She was just the meanest, bitchiest girl in junior high, and I hated her. She was so mean to me, so I just put her in the song. Like, but this is how many years later? So, 20-something years later, I get and that was like seventh grade. I'm playing Denver back again, and the album is just about to come out. Oh, I'm selling it. It just came out. And this woman comes up to me.
You're selling it at a table at the...
Yeah. And this woman comes up to me, and she goes, Jill, and she... Guess who this is? And here's... I want you to meet my daughter. This is Carol Fingle. We haven't bought the new album, but we love your last one so much.
Uh-oh.
And all that kind of pain and anxiety I had for her all those years just went away.
So did you learn never to use real names again in your songwriting?
Yeah, except I did on the California years. I'm talking about old flames, and I used, it's called Wendell Lee, the song, and there was actually the first time I ever did it. Was a guy named Wendell Lee, and I didn't think I'd ever see him again. And of course, when the album came out, I got an email from Wendell, but it wasn't mean spirited. It was, my song. We had a good laugh, and we still talk to each other on the internet. So.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Take me back. Take me home to the world that never, to the world that never was. Cones of Roman candles in the sky, 4th of July. The dogs crouched in the basement, Dad was still alive. The fading gray Super 8 makes everything seem really great, and I look happy as a clown. Take me back, take me home to the world that never, to the world that never, to the world that another birthday party with the braces on my legs. The rented clown made cotton candy and animal. into the lens. And hey, there's Carol Fangle before she sliced her wrist.
Super 8 by the late Jill Sobule. Tonight we're listening to a recorded interview with her from 2017. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf.
Well, so when you delivered Happy Town, did Atlantic say, you know, where's I Kissed a Girl Too? Where's there, you know?
Yeah, they weren't, for some reason they weren't really happy. You could tell that they weren't promoted. They weren't putting money behind it. And I really love that record. So then after that got released, they dropped me. But, but it was really funny. That album is, you know, it's a museum in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
They have an exhibit of censored music, and they show that album cover of Happy Town, because the original one had, like Saul Bass, the illustrator of All the Bond and Man with the Golden Arm. It shows like those hands opening up a Prozac tablet and sprinkling Prozac things on all this little town, and the label said Walmart wouldn't play it because it was somehow promoting drugs, which they sell, and they thought that the granules coming out looked like cocaine, which never would have occurred to me. So we had to change it to beakers. So on the at the museum, they have both album covers.
So it was a capsule that's being pulled apart as opposed
right.
to a two beakers. And did they say Happy Town on the pill?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I love the cover. It's a great cover.
It's a great cover. And then, you know the song Bitter?
Yes.
Well, they originally wanted me to take out the word bitch in it because I felt, again, Kmart wouldn't play it. And I felt that was stupid because there's songs that have bitch in it. The bitch is back.
Now you have to have bitch in a song. They're not allowed to play it on the radio unless it says bitch.
I know. So I went back into the studio and I replaced bitch with cunt.
I'm sure they were much happier with that.
They didn't think it was funny at all. This could have been the beginning of the demise of my time.
I can't imagine why they would have been unhappy with you, Joe.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it didn't matter. It didn't stop you. You continued to make records.
That's when, you know, still things were still a little happening in the music industry, and I went on a small, kind of a promising medium-sized indie label called Beyond, and it didn't last that long, but continued.
So that was Pink Pearl. Was that your next
that
one?
That was Pink Pearl.
Another great record, by the way.
I love that record.
Yeah, it's great. Got some great songs. I'm sure you still play all these songs when you're doing shows.
Yeah, I you know what's really good is I bought one of the big iPads.
Yeah.
So that I can have all my lyrics on it. So even if I forget things, someone asks for a song, I try to always sing it for some reason.
Frank Sinatra, you know, used to have a teleprompter at his feet.
Well, yeah.
Oh, sure. Can't remember everything. I always wonder that about songwriters. You know, how do they keep all those lyrics in their head? Think about Bob Dylan. Think about all those songs he has to keep in his head.
I don't know. I'm not good at it.
Yeah. Of course, with Dylan, you can't tell if he's singing the word or not because he can't.
That's true. Like Desolation Row, how does he remember all of it?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I don't know. I couldn't.
Yeah.
Me and Frank.
You guys have a lot in common.
Yeah. And Willie Nelson does, too.
Yeah, he has a teleprompter?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't. I would.
Well, yeah.
I think when I saw Lucinda Williams last time, she had like a music stand with like a notebook. She just turns a lot of,
well, especially if I like to try new songs, and so I haven't memorized most of them, or a lot of them. So.
And you play, how many concerts a year do you play?
God, maybe 80.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
Well, that's what you do. But is that a thing? It's like, you know, do you still make records, but which is the thing? Is it making the record or doing this show?
I like both. I mean, I've been avoiding doing a record, and I think for various reasons. And right now I'm giving myself a deadline, but I mean, I love recording. I love, and it's a different world now. I mean, I don't know many people unless they're upper echelon. I mean, I don't know that many people that now can make money on their songwriting or their records.
It used to be the concert promoted the record, and now the record promotes the concert.
Right.
Yeah.
Probably well, like it was in the old days.
Maybe. Well, I was asking you about when I was saying that you kind of straddled this all these changes in the music industry. You were one of the first, you know, like Kickstarter. You're a pioneer of Kickstarter, right?
I was. What was it? 2008. A friend and I said, you know what? I have no desire to try to get another. You know, to get out there and audition for another record deal, and they're not like that anymore anyway. It's changing. So, and over a bottle of wine, we thought, well, why don't you ask your fans? And I go, but I want to give them something in return. And there was no Kickstarter. So we came up with this idea of tiered, you know, levels of gifts and services for different donations. So from I had a polished rock to weapons-grade plutonium, which means that you would get to sing with me.
Oh.
And somehow the AP and CNN got a hold of it, and it did really well. And then a few months later, a friend who was helped startups, she said, would you talk to these two guys who are interested in what you're doing? And then they started Kickstarter, and I'm like, damn, why didn't I think of doing a business? You know, so.
Well, it was your idea, or you should have patented it.
I know. so that was
internet busking.
So that was that, and I was there were people did it before me, but at the beginning of doing the house concerts and. Always trying to think of new things to figure out how to keep doing what I love to do.
Well, when you're a songwriter, I don't know because I'm not a songwriter, but I think a lot of the stuff that you write, it seems like songwriters have their, maybe that's what they were talking about when they said you were 27, that you're too old, because so many of those singer-songwriters got started much earlier, and then by the time they were 30, you know, they were kind of done writing their best songs. But you've, you know, sort of continued all these years. Do you have to look for different sources? Can you still be autobiographical?
You can be. I mean, I think it's because I'm not trying to write pop songs again. I know I won't be on, you know, top 20 radio, whatever that is. So you also write what you know. and I think a lot of maybe writers, my middle-aged writers, want to still write like they're teenagers. I mean, wouldn't you love to hear a song, or maybe you want, but I wouldn't mind hearing a song from the Stones about just how, you know, how hard it is to get up in the morning. You know? You know? I mean, there's something of honesty, and that's why some of the writers who have lasted, from your Leonard Cohens to, you know, they don't try to hold on to being 18 anymore.
Hmm. Paul Simon would come to mind there,
Paul
too.
Paul Simon, yeah. So even The Boss.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also you've written about some real-life people, like your song about Bobby Gentry.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing, is I like writing stories, so that's different. That's why, I like working on musicals or, I like little short stories.
The writer David Haydu, who has written a biography of Bob Dylan, a history of the comic book scandals of the 1950s, and many other great books, collaborated with Jill Sobule on an album in 2025. Here is a song they wrote together for that album, sung by Karen Oberlin, called The Angel in the Attic.
Contain this, I said. You have to explain this, I said. I'm young, I'm tired, I don't understand. He gave me a smile. We walked up the stair. I know what you're after, he said. Climb under the rafter, he said, and look for the angel who's living up there. I'm waiting, I'm waiting for the angel, the angel in the attic. I'm waiting for my moment with the angel. Alone with the boxes, the bric-brac and things. The lock clicked behind me, I thought, would anyone find me? I thought, no lights, no halo, no lady with wings. I pushed up the window, I had to get down. Come join me outside, dear, she said. We'll go for a ride, dear, she said. I held her and flew with her over the town. I'm waiting, waiting for the angel, the angel in the attic. I'm waiting with the angels. We twirled, we swooped,
And you collaborate a lot with David Haidu was on the show a little while ago, and he sent me this.
I love writing with authors.
He sent me this CD, Waiting for the Angel. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, I've known David for a while. I remember the first time it was an interview, and I don't know if it was for the New York Times. I think it was. And somehow we became friends. And also, I loved his work. I loved his books. And, you know, he knows his history of pop music and folk music. And so it's always, you know, fascinating to just listen to him he's also a really creative writer and a lyricist. And not all authors are great lyricists. It's really not many people can write.
It's two separate.
I can't get no satisfaction, you know.
It's two separate skills, being able to write a book and being able to write a song.
Right. Mm-hmm. And David's one of the ones that does both.
What's your favorite song on this CD?
I like Waiting for the Angel.
Yeah.
God, there's so many good ones. But, you know, I'm biased because that's the one I hear. I keep coming. I'm trying to think of songs I want to do on my record, and I'm thinking of maybe doing that one. So that's why I've been listening to that one a lot.
And you've also worked, you've worked with so many interesting people. You worked with Julia Sweeney, and I assume you met her at a concert in Monterey near the jellyfish tank. Because
I did. It was one of the early TED conferences, and we were both, she was speaking and I was doing something. And we were both mutual fans of each other, and I found out she lived a couple blocks from me in Los Angeles, and so I would have her come. I played this place called Largo regularly, and I'd have her come, and I'd go, why don't you just tell a story? And then I'd play a song, and then it just became this thing that it was an excuse to hang out with each other. And she's genius. I mean, have you seen any of her one-woman shows?
Well, God Said Ah is so fantastic.
It's fantastic, and Letting Go of God. So I really, and Julia's just at this point where she goes, and she's writing screenplays now, and she's got a daughter, and she doesn't want to go out on the road, and, you know, and so we don't do it as much as we used to, but it was really a joy. I would sing a song, and she would tell a story that had something to do with it, or vice versa.
Well, it's interesting pairing, because both of you have these moments in your past. You have I Kissed a Girl, and she has
Pat.
It's Pat, yeah, that are, you know, these sort of legendary things that everybody knows. And now you're these veterans who are still here creating great stuff.
Yeah, and we also have the same curses, where a lot of people know me for the novelty song, and a lot of people just know her for Pat, and they don't know this body of intelligent, funny, beautiful work that she does. I think we kind of felt we had some sort of kinship.
So when you were sort of out of the limelight, and then Katy Perry recorded a song with a title called I Kissed a Girl, I don't know, did that burn you up? Did you?
No, although one time a friend interviewed me for the Rumpus Room, and I was like, he goes, how do you really feel? And I went off on this just, you know, over-the-top goofball thing, and somehow the next day I got, Perez Hilton started saying, you know, bitter and angry. I was horrified, and then I got all this hate mail from all these
Katy Perry fans,
young fan girls. But you know, I wrote a bunch of them back, and it was like a bunch of them are my pals, you know. So are my Facebook friends, not. And but no, on one hand, you know, there was a lot of 14-year-old girls that accidentally bought my record, so more power.
And the other I Kissed a Girl, and they got yours.
Yeah, bummer. And then but you know, you can't copyright
a title. Right.
Title. So, but I did. I wish I would have done it. I wanted to do a record right afterwards of just taking, having original songs, but titles like Midnight at the Oasis, Paperback Writer. You know,
I've got you under my skin.
Yeah, it makes no sense, but it would have been fun.
Or how about California Girls? Or
she did that.
Yeah, no, but I mean, you could do it. With the
I could have done it. Oh, my God, that'd be a third time.
That's right.
It's actually a really funny idea.
It is. Did you ever meet Katy Perry? Have you ever talked to her about this?
No, I never have. I know people that know her, but, you know, and I didn't, you know, I have to say there was a little bit of a bias I mean, there was Kiss the Girl wars, not, you know, there wasn't a big war, but there was like old timers that said, you know, that hers, you know, the old one was really more, you know, gay positive, and, you know, Katie's was more of I'm going to kiss a girl because it's flirty and it'll turn on my boyfriend, and, you know, so, but, you know, to me, if it had an effect on, you know, a young girl that maybe you know, that's an okay thing to do, then more power to her. And she's turned out, you know, she's become active and semi-active. You know, she's become active in the political realm with Hillary, and, you know, so I got to give her, you know, a lot of credit.
You gave her her start.
Yeah, I gave her start. Well, here's the interesting thing was, her A&R guy was my A&R guy when I did I Kissed a Girl.
Oh, so it was no accident that...
I guess not. I don't know.
That's interesting. It's very interesting.
But she did well.
With that song? Yeah, well, she's done... Well, she's done. People have heard of her, yeah. Thanks to you. And you've done well, too. And I'm so happy that... You finally reached the pinnacle of your career by being here on From the Bookshelf with me.
This was, really, this was the pinnacle, and I thank you so much.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, I enjoyed talking with you, and thank you so much.
Jill Sobule, recorded in 2017. She died at the age of 66 on May 1st, 2025.
Supermodel. So beautiful. I'm gonna be a supermodel. And I'm so beautiful.
a supermodel.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.